I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Preventable. How a pandemic changed the world and how to stop the next one. Professor Devi Shidhar has risen to prominence for her vital roles in communicating science to the public and speaking truth to power. In Preventable, she highlights lessons learned from outbreaks past and present in a narrative that traces the COVID-19 pandemic, including her personal experience as a scientist, and sets out a vision for how we can better protect ourselves from the inevitable health crisis to come. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, the author of Preventable, Professor Devi Shidhar. Professor, good morning to you.
Morning.
Good, thank you for joining us. It has been an interesting time, shall we say, to be a scientist.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's, you never want to be the bearer of bad news, and unfortunately there's been a lot of bad news in the past 2 years. It's been a tricky one to obviously want to tell people reassuring things and happy things, but at the same time have to communicate science and what was unfolding.
So what was your take on what was unfolding, and where were you, and what was your reaction? Because we had these reports coming about outbreaks on cruise ships, people being quarantined in hotels, sitting in Spain. We heard about the northern Italian regions going to lockdown, and we thought, gosh, that must be terrible. And then literally 8 weeks later, we were in the thick of it ourselves.
Yeah, so I think even going back earlier among the global health security community, those of us who kind of track infectious disease outbreaks and kind of follow them up, there was already buzzing in early January. There was already like information by late December 2019, early January 2020, there was a new virus circulating. China was alerted. They weren't sure what this was. It didn't seem to be something they had seen before. And but again, there wasn't yet panic setting in because we were just like, well, maybe, you know, China will manage it. Maybe it'll go away. We don't know if it's human-to-human transmission. But by mid-January 2020, when Wuhan went into lockdown and China was saying, oh, we're really struggling to keep a handle on this, and they were building hospitals in a week to try to keep on top of their patient numbers, there was this feeling of, uh-oh, this is going to be really bad. And how do we start getting governments to acknowledge the challenge they're going to face with the respiratory fast-moving virus that has, for some people, absolutely no health consequences, and for others, it's deadly.
Because, I mean, we've had outbreaks in, you know, around that area before in Asia. I mean, we've had avian flu, we had the SARS outbreaks. So people were sort of, well, this is something happening over there. Was it, you know, so we don't have to worry about it too much. Was there complacency there? And were people not following the science? I believe one scientist was jailed in Wuhan in the early days.
Yeah, well, I think the problem is first, China, the Chinese government didn't want to cause kind of ramifications for their economy or for their international tourism or trade. So they basically said, everything's fine, we're going to manage it, don't worry, and kind of were trying, I think, to underplay the threat that was there. And by the time it was fully recognized it was happening, the virus had been seeded in so many places. And places that had experience with SARS or MERS and other coronavirus, like South Korea, reacted really quickly because they had dealt with these kind of outbreaks. So they just activated, in a way, their plans and said, well, actually, we've dealt with worse, you know, MERS killed a third of people who get it. So they were thinking, oh, my, this is going to be really bad. Where I think in Europe, probably in Spain and Britain, there was a feeling of, oh, how bad could it be? Swine flu was a near miss. SARS was never really a problem here. We're kind of used to things not hitting us. And so there was a sense of kind of sluggishness with getting ahead of it and actually, oh, it's going to go away without thinking, well, actually, there are certain characteristics of this virus, which means it has pandemic potential and it became a pandemic.
I mean, you know, if you watch a Hollywood movie, a disaster movie, etc., it's always the scientists who are saying, you know, don't muck with that dinosaur DNA, or don't build next to that fault line, or look out for that meteorite. And it's always the politicians who go, no, no, it's going to miss us, it won't come near us. Was it somewhat feeling like that? It was the fact that we have politicians who haven't been trained in sciences, and who, due to one thing and the other, now say, oh, we've had enough of experts, and the scientists are just overplaying this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was definitely there because, you know, you were saying, again, completely rationally, saying, well, look, this is a virus. It seems to spread asymptomatically or pre-symptomatically, meaning you can't just chase on symptoms. You have to be testing people. And I think there was a lot of kind of discussion about, you know, what's the IFR or the infection fatality rate? How many people would it kill? But the real problem for governments was deeper than that. It was a hospitalization rate. That's what was going to get you, because if your hospital filled up and collapsed, it wouldn't just be COVID killing people. It'd be people who couldn't get care for appendicitis or heart attacks or road traffic injuries. And so I think, you know, when Wuhan and Chinese scientists were saying, well, about 20% of people who get this are hospitalized, that was what they were saying in January. That should have rung alarm bells. And it did ring alarm bells in West Africa, where health ministers heard this and said, well, we couldn't even manage if it was 1%. We don't have enough hospitals. We don't have decent primary care. So they moved quickly to say, we can't have cases. Mali closed its borders before its first case because they said, we can't even afford that rate. But I think in, you know, Europe, the idea of we have health care, there's enough doctors, there's enough systems, we can kind of muddle our way through it. And once Lombardy fell, one of the wealthiest regions in the world, a very good health system, that should have been the warning in February to every place in the world that if they couldn't manage it, no place could manage it.
It's an interesting, wasn't it? Because you mentioned Mali and places like Vietnam as well. And you know, these places which are, you know, sorry for calling them such third world countries, they knew that their health systems wouldn't be able to take any sort of pressure. So they just went bam, didn't they?
Well, exactly. I think they looked very early, and or as early as January, and thought, well, how do we get through this? What are our options? And they took the options of actually, well, we're just going to close our borders. We're going to take the hit to tourism, to our airline industry, but we're going to protect our domestic economy, because they knew they didn't have the money to put in place furlough packages or economic support packages to support people domestically. So they said, okay, we'd rather save the 80 or 90% of the economy and let the 10% go, and kind of wait and hold. And the real challenge has been, now that vaccines have come along, getting access to those vaccines, getting adequate supply to kind of exit, which is what we've seen has been the exit, which is mass vaccination, access to antivirals, good testing systems, oxygen in hospitals, and then you can kind of lift restrictions and try to live alongside this virus, though it is bumpy. They're now struggling with actually getting adequate supply.
Because the whole vaccine rollout as well was fraught with politics and economics and claims and counterclaims. What was it like as a scientist sort of seeing this all unfold? And you obviously are dealing with medical bodies as well, health workers who were put under extreme strain. I mean, my sister is a head nurse, and she went through some interesting times as well. What was your reaction to the developments? Because it also mutated as well.
Well, yeah. Well, I think early on, the real challenge for healthcare workers was being sent on to wards, not understanding how this was transmitting. Were they at risk themselves of contracting the virus, not having access to testing, and not even having access to proper PPE to understand the real threat of it? So you did see in the first wave many healthcare workers actually getting COVID, because they're most at risk of it. They're the ones being exposed to high viral loads, to very sick patients, and having to figure out, well, how do we treat this? At first, it was seen as a pneumonia, but then quickly, doctors, nurses, other health personnel realize, well, actually, this isn't just a respiratory disease. It's affecting the lungs, it's affecting blood vessels, it's affecting the heart, it's affecting the brain. And so I think that was such a steep learning curve. And more time, and that's what I also say, the countries that kind of bought time by saying, we're going to just suppress, we're not going to take that wave of cases, got time to get PPE and for their healthcare workers, got time to tell them clinically how best to treat this. So now when you see New Zealand taking a wave, and South Korea, or even places like Hong Kong, they've had that knowledge from the doctors here, the nurses here, and the health systems here to understand, okay, this isn't completely unknown. We've been dealing with this for almost 2 years, and I've been able to learn in that way.
I mean, do you think it's now a case that we are going to be better prepared? Because obviously Shanghai's back in lockdown because of overconfidence by government. I mean, the government seems to be saying, especially in the UK, we've weathered the pandemic, even though I think it was 600 and something deaths the other day. Do you think that perhaps governments will say, okay, we got over this one, we're fully prepared for whatever comes? Because the problem with these diseases is we don't know when they're going to strike and we don't know what sort of form they're going to take.
Yeah, so I think right now what you are seeing a lot of governments learning from COVID is first that buying time through trying to delay spread or stop spread makes sense. There was kind of a cynical fatalism at the start that we would be in the same position 2 years down. And the point I try to make to people, even if they get COVID now, is getting Omicron after three vaccines is totally different to getting the original SARS-CoV-2 with absolutely no protection. But on the flip side, I think countries are realizing if they aren't able to mass vaccinate, this is a problem in China and Hong Kong, especially elderly groups, then there's a problem of course, deaths among those groups. In a sense, you have to use that time to vaccinate, to protect, to open up, rather than just hoping that the virus would go away. And so zero COVID was great as a holding strategy until vaccines. But once vaccines came on, you had to pivot, as you've seen South Korea do and New Zealand do, and I think Taiwan is now going to do that, to say, okay, we're going to live alongside it. We're going to have to take waves. There are going to be deaths, but far less than in the pre-vaccine era.
What's it like, because this, you know, we live in an age of social media and people putting their opinions out there, and this quickly became a divisive issue, and the vaccine riot became a divisive issue, and masks became a divisive issue, and some people were saying this is not what you think it was. We had the whole pandemic situation. I mean, is it like to work as a scientist when you're seeing that sort of narrative come across and that sort of narrative taking center stage?
Yeah, so I think there's been a real problem with social media, particularly Facebook, YouTube, and misinformation. And people seeing this as a chance to actually spread what I would call lies about the virus, either that it's a hoax, doesn't exist, that there are miracle cures like ivermectin, that masks don't work, kind of these things, and getting a big platform of people who are really frustrated with how COVID has changed their lives and quite angry about what it's meant for them financially, socially, for their mental health. And so in a way, that frustration they have found I found someone on YouTube who's saying what I want to hear. And that's been really difficult because, of course, all of us in the scientific community wanted to say, oh, it's going to disappear, or of course, we're not going to take any more deaths, or of course. But instead, we had to be out there and saying very difficult things and saying, well, there are trade-offs in terms of how you actually find your way through this crisis. So it has been really frustrating, and I'm mostly kind of sad looking, for example, at the United States, where I'm from, where they have adequate supply. They're trying to roll out vaccines, but so many people are not getting vaccinated and dying, even today, because they've read somewhere online that vaccines don't work or they have these really awful side effects. And so they're scared. And the point being, the side effects from COVID are far worse than of the vaccine. And I wish that's what makes me really sad, because that kind of misinformation is actually killing people on a day-to-day basis. And I think it is really hard for people on COVID wards who are seeing people coming in and asking them, are you vaccinated? They're saying no. And then they're saying, well, can I have the vaccine now? And well, too late. You're now really sick and we're going to try to save you. But if you had had the vaccine, you probably wouldn't be in hospital. And I think that's been really tricky with social media and kind of especially the anti-vax movement, which does seem to kind of spread lies and kind of ignite over that platform and then in a sense, have consequences for people's health.
The book takes several sort of viewpoints. You go from the bored passengers in lockdown or in quarantine on a cruise line at the beginning through to some sort of crisis rooms and government. Why did you decide to take that approach to preventable?
Well, I started out writing a very academic book, as my previous books have been, for a quite technical audience. And I thought, actually, this is a fascinating story of the race against time to understand the virus spreading, to understand on a cruise ship, this is a natural lab of people stuck on this ship. How is it spreading? Who's actually testing positive? How many people is this killing? What are their health outcomes? And also trying to take people inside the room of how difficult the decisions were and the advice to be given. So I have a lot of in-depth details about children in schools, which has been one of the most emotive issues. And there are people who are saying, from the start, children have been super spreaders. Schools have never should have been open. On the flip side, people say, schools should never have been shut. Look at the huge consequences we've seen in terms of child abuse and increased educational inequalities. And I kind of try to navigate that in the middle, saying, these were all the considerations being discussed. And this is what it was like to be in the room at the time. When you're asked, should we open schools tomorrow? And you have a union sitting there and teachers looking at you, and a lot of teachers over the age of 50 or have pre-existing health issues. You have a child welfare officer sitting there who's telling you about the children at home who have no access to social care or supportive adults who are going to be struggling. You know, these are the things in the room, and you're trying to provide advice, which eventually goes to politicians who have to look at that advice and make a very difficult decision of, do we open schools or not? And I think that's what I try to do in my book, to show to people, we hear a lot of kind of headlines, we hear a lot of strong statements being made, but the truth was, this was an evolving situation, and it was very difficult in those situations to know what was the right thing to do or the best thing to do. All you could do is kind of document the various angles, try to present the best data, and then give that to ministers.
I mean,
and then they would have to look at that.
The subtitle heading is How a Pandemic Changed the World and How to Stop the Next One. How do we stop the next one when we don't know what form it will take?
Well, talking about your disaster movie, I mean, the first thing is we need to stay away from animals, especially wild animals, and also treat our domesticated animals better. These are all coming from animals at wet markets, in bat caves. I mean, this is where Ebola came from. Mosquitoes, we know, are a major problem. So we kind of have to look at our relationship with the animal kingdom and start saying, well, why are we seeing hot spots across the world? And how do we regulate them better to limit the ability of these viruses circulating in bats or in rats or in raccoon dogs being able to jump into humans? Because once we know once it's in humans and it spreads the way SARS-CoV-2 does, airborne, you know, among people very quickly, even if they feel well, becomes harder and harder to stop for governments. And we've seen that with the variants and how the race has become even more and more difficult to stay ahead of it. So yeah, so it goes through kind of four or five things we should be thinking about now. But the key element is really there's millions of viruses in the animal kingdom. And every once in a while, one gets the chance to jump into a human. It has the potential for human-to-human transmission. And then we're chasing that. So we have to look at the hot spots. Why are they in certain parts of Africa and certain parts of Asia? And how do we regulate that better? Because it doesn't matter if it's miles and miles away. We know it'll arrive on our doorstep on a flight within hours, if not days.
You see, that is the thing, isn't it? Now, in a world of international travel, it can be anywhere in the world in less than 24 hours.
Exactly. I think the speed of this even took us by surprise, by how quickly it was even in places like Antarctica. I mean, it was just, or in tribal communities in Brazil, the idea you could have a virus. And it just shows how connected we are. And especially coming out of Wuhan, which is a travel hub, how quickly you would have flights taking off and it being seeded into various places. And also the difficulty in actually wanting to seal off to the world. I mean, New Zealand did it, Vietnam did it. But is that right in a globalized world? Is it sustainable? Is it a short-term plan? Or in the end, and I think that's going to be where we're going to be discussing a lot for the next one, which is, do travel restrictions make sense? At what point do you stop people moving internationally? What's the role of testing there? Just to try to kind of buy time until we get a vaccine or an antiviral therapy or some kind of scientific breakthrough to help us manage it.
What do you hope that people take from the book Preventable?
I think first, hopefully they reflect on what we've lived through in the past 2 years and how each of us might have changed or learned things about ourselves, and also to take a global look of, you know, we might have been sitting in Spain, but what was South Korea doing at the time? What was Senegal doing? And actually, what was the United States? What was happening there? So in a way, we were all kind of in our national bubble, our local bubble, but actually this was all happening, the exact same crisis in different countries, but they all kind of reacted in different ways. And I find that fascinating. For the same challenge of a virus spreading, how governments take such divergent approaches. So I think that hopefully is interesting for people. And secondly, to reflect on, for the next pandemic, what are things we've learned from COVID? What have we did badly? What did we do well? What are scientists thinking about in terms of the next frontier? And kind of leave with some hope that we have gotten better and better at managing pandemics. I mean, it seemed that way with COVID, but actually, if you look at the scientific progress, it's probably a success, because if we hadn't had vaccines, billions of more people would have died. And that's the real takeaway, that a vaccine was developed within a year. And I talk about that in the book, the race for a vaccine. How did the teams do it so quickly? How every day mattered to them, and how now they're trying to go even faster to develop platforms. So for the next pathogen, they can do it maybe in half a year or 100 days. How do we speed it up so we can save more lives in the future?
The book is called Preventable, How a Pandemic Changed the World and How to Stop the Next One. It's by Devi Shivra, who we've been speaking to today. Devi, if people want to find more information about the book or about yourself, are you on the social medias? Is there a website? Where can people get hold of you?
Yes, I'm very active on Twitter, on my handle, Devi Shridhar, or it's on Penguin, it's on Amazon, and it's out this Thursday, and I hope people will enjoy it, get it from their library or their local bookshop, and, you know, think about where we are and hopefully where we're going.
The book is called Preventable, How a Pandemic Changed the World and How to Stop the Next One. It's by Debbie Shitar, who we've been speaking to today, and it will also be available as a virtual download from our virtual bookstore. The book is called Preventable. Debbie Shitar, thank you so much for your time today.
Cheers. Thank you. Bye.